Hey. I feel weird actually reading a thing and not just kind of rambling at y'all. That's how I live my life, but I'm going to read this paper. Well, also, and thanks to the other reader and the other introduction. Those were beautiful. It's a challenge to introduce a reader like Jeffrey Skinner. Consider his bio. He's a poet, playwright, and essayist who recently was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in Poetry for a project involving a conflation of contemporary physics, poetry, and theology. Physics, poetry, and theology. I think I failed physics back in high school like 15 years ago, so a little intimidated. That's a true fact. But yeah, so when looking over such like a wide breadth of work, it's hard to know where to begin or how to cover it all. So I'll do the easy thing, and I'll start with one of the poems that I loved, which I had said is hopefully not one he planned on reading, but apparently it's all new material, so I'm golden. Sorry, the interjections happen. All right. In the field and everywhere, I am never far from mother. Mother covers my face with her tail, and the brightness of sky is split. Where there is danger, mother puts her body between me and danger. The cult begins. The poem is called The Cult. It ends. Tired now of maintaining this poem in the voice of a young horse, I rise and walk out, enormous brain wobbling on toothpicks. This is what I love about Skinner's poems, how he puts himself in the heart and souls of so many, and how he so fluidly connects one living experience to another. The cult is a cult, and it is not the poet, but it is the poet, as he explains. What Skinner leaves behind in the poem is not, perhaps, as important as what he takes with him. He is separate but the same, echoing the cult in movement and mind. His poem, Like Water, illustrates the central aspect of his work well, which he's also not reading, so yay. Speaking directly of souls, he writes of the oldest and youngest one's desires, and then finds their collective need. All of them whisper, sing, are saddened by memory like us. This is why they must return. Like ice, their time in this state is brief. And whether soul finds body or body finds soul is never made clear. But once the match is made, the soul pours in like water, taking the shape of whatever it fills. How beautiful for poems to replicate what souls do. How beautiful for poems to know what souls do. Lastly, consider Hey 19, another poem he will not read tonight. I hope this is true. Am I good? Okay, cool. Skinner inhabits a 19-year-old narrator working on a summer construction job with as much grace and finesse as he does animals and bodiless souls, and manages to connect to this thesis that I hope he has, that I made up that he has, of connectivity, too. That day lasted all summer, and I stayed inside myself, a boarder in my parents' house, scrambling eggs in the kitchen while mother ripped through her mysteries in the den. There was a lost love involved, naturally, and an old grammar school friend who turned up one night with a zigzag scar down his cheek and a baggie of good dope. We climbed the reservoir fence at midnight, sat by a doubled moon at the lake shore, and talked about Chinese poets till dawn. We agreed that rebirth gets tiresome, even within one life. Rebirth, though, never gets tiresome in Skinner's work. It's a pleasure and a privilege to wander through the worlds he presents, to marvel at the differences but feel the pulse of similarity from one experience to the next. Skinner's poems offer me the gift of movement and connection between souls, and I hope they offer you the same, too. Poet, playwright, and essayist. That was my transition nod. Poet, playwright, and essayist Jeffrey Skinner was awarded a 2014 Guggenheim Fellowship in Poetry for his project involving a conflation of contemporary physics, poetry, and theology. I did not make that up. He served as the June 2015 Artist in Residence at the Kern Particle Accelerator in Geneva, Switzerland. In 2015, he was awarded one of the 8 American Academy of Arts and Letters Awards for exceptional accomplishment in writing. His most recent prose book, The 6.5 Practices of Moderately Successful Poets, was published to wide attention and acclaim, including a full-page positive review in the Sunday New York Times Book Review. His most recent collection of poems, Chance Divine, won the Field Poetry Award and was published in February 2017. His previous book of poems, Glaciology, 2013, was chosen in 2012 as winner in the Crab Orchard Open Poetry Competition. Skinner has published 5 other poetry collections. Also a playwright, Skinner's play, Downrange, has had successful runs in New York City, Chicago, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. His play Dream On had its premiere production in February 2007 by the Cardboard Box Collaborative Theater in Philadelphia. Other of Skinner's plays have been finalists in the Eugene O'Neill Theater Conference Competition and winners in various play contests. Skinner serves as president of the board of directors and editorial consultant for Saraband Books, a literary publishing house he co-founded with his wife, poet Sarah Gorham. Please welcome Jeffrey Skinner.
Hello, good evening. I'm very glad to be here. I want to thank Jimmy and the school itself, FSU, and all of you students for coming out tonight to listen to writing. I'm going to start with a poem that's also about a 19-year-old who bears a resemblance to me, and it's just coincidence that Ruth read that poem. This is a recent one, and I'm going to read all recent work tonight. I've never read these poems before, so I'm going to keep my head down. Don't think that that's my typical way. Usually I try and connect with the audience a little bit more, but as Sarah said, tonight I'm going to be impenetrable and hyper-attenuated, so I better keep my head down, you know what I'm saying? This is called Love and Judgment. Of course, it was October, I think, maybe evening at least. That's when most things happened suddenly inside me. Happened on the skeleton of a bird at forest's edge, a crispy light in and around the scrub-clean matchstick bones, white now as God's teeth and as necessary, weightless, nearly between thumb and index finger, picking up the skull, a deep look, my eyes so focused and sharp in those days. And the ant crawled out in tiny panic from eye socket. Onto my finger, I dropped the skull, though it hardly made any difference in hand's weight, flung up, ant flying off. Continued with purpose, forget the girl, what girl, no matter. Walked through abandoned graveyard, names all chewed by time, unreadable stone, the smell of lake water, floating just beyond opaque, tannic black from surface, down to mush black mud, took shoes off, walked out. A bit numb girl's face on surface broken on the way back, picked up skull again, blew hard through eye hole until clean, dropped in shirt pocket, light as origamied rolling paper, remembered thinking skull white and necessary as God's teeth. Why necessary? Carried the question from forest and memory of some girl almost loved. But what was love and judgment against 19 years old? Everything weightless as a sparrow skull in pocket. Bobbing as I jog through autumn, the barred owls calling out, what do you know? What do you know? What do you know? Thanks. As Sarah said so kindly, my hearing is going. It's not completely gone yet, but it's going. And so I sometimes mishear things, and this is a poem about mishearing. It's called Chocolate Cecil. I misheard a commercial this morning, thought they were selling Chocolate Cecil. Didn't know what it was, but it sounded good. I wanted some. And this is the way I suppose hawkers figure. People hear only flying shards of their ads. So every word and or image must have something shiny or sweet stuck to it. And here my mind inserts like a poem. But I'm retired and don't get paid to think that way anymore. I don't get paid to think at all. It's just me and the dog, plus earbud, music, coffee, notebook, no one caring. What kind of word factory I've become? Not that anyone much did before, but now Zippo, which I can't, upon sober reflection, say doesn't release and calm me, because it does, at least when I am of sober mind. Otherwise, like everyone else, I want to be spoken of and remembered. What Achilles wanted, what kids show you with their big heads, eyes, and sticky outstretched palms. Also, most of the writers I followed and loved are dead. They're not talked about or read anymore, which is amazing to me. I got so high reading Bartholomew, for example, in the West End Cafe, slamming shots and beer. There I could turn either right or left and blubber on about how his stories reached into my chest, curled a finger around the comic trigger of existence, and pulled, and off I went, a center shot pinata, laughter and candy flying every which way. And the woman I had turned to would know. She would know who and what I was talking about. But no more. I don't read the new writers. I'm sure they're great. I just feel closer to the dead ones. They were of me, of my time, which is why new people need new writers. For them, it's radical. To me, humans seem more and more made of the same material. What distinguishes us is where we're headed and what we take with us on the ride. I'm bearing down on God. I take my fellow drunks and the people of my flesh and the making of poems, vanity, stubbornness, hope, and the occasional bar of chocolate Cecil, or whatever sweet thing I could pluck from thin air and make real. Thank you. That's very kind. So, as you hear in this poem, my mom is in a home. She doesn't know where, but she is, and this poem sort of comes out of it, out of that experience, which I'm still going through. It's very strange to take care of somebody who took care of you, and I'm sure a lot of you have had that experience, but it's strange. It's called The Dog and Mother Show, and it's in four parts, so I'll read 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, the basset is soon to die, but flops up to me as always for petting, because no one has told her. And I would not, if I could, foreknowledge of death's a dubious gift at best. And she has neither language nor need. My life, on the other hand, is made largely of words, maybe even the word, some hocus-pocus mix of diction and matter, amuse-bouche I swallowed long ago. It returns to me sometimes on a wind of uncertain origin, the window open, the notebook on the desk open, the page twitching like my heart the first time I saw my true love nude. 2. My mother is soon to die, though it is a fact that many others will die before her. But useless to talk death to her, she has lost reams of language, memory made of language, vanished and vanishing, time uncoupling synapses, and each day less of her to die, which is a dubious gift at best. When we talk at the table in the common room, my words fade in the bandaged air on the way to her hearing. She stares at the wallpaper, trying to sort out who in the photographs I lay before her is still extant, who gone. Suddenly, she's amused, triumphant, at how surprised her husband will be when she sees the invoice for, quote, this place, whatever this place is, and, smiling, I have the bills, 5, sometimes, some months, even 6 figures. But my father is dead. 3. Someone is always soon to die. I want to take this fact and throw it against the wall, knowing it is biological. With sufficient force, the membrane will tear, the guts burst and drip down. I know because I've done it in the past. What other reason compels us to stop short, to leave the here and now they keep telling us to live in and think like a motherfucker? As if death itself might tremble at a thought. Long and deep and sharp enough. A dubious idea at best. Voice says, how's that working out for you? 4. When I bring my mother over to the house for family gatherings, the basset comes up and sits by her to be petted, and mom does, and the dog stays with her there at the far edge of language as the children snatch each other's toys and the smell of pot roast suffuses. And the Lord is with us and with our spirit. Thank you. The next few poems are kind of like the common consciousness of the moment seeping into me. And I don't ever consciously write about that kind of thing. And I suppose it's probably a deficiency, but I can't do everything, you know. And I think some people are meant for that and some are not. But it seeps in anyway. You know, the culture we live in can't help but do that. So here, these are some poems about being a man today, I think. And you'll recognize, I think, where some of this comes from. This first poem is called The Truth About Men. I was around 7 when mother found my drawing of a naked woman. Although I was hazy about female anatomy, I had recently surprised her as she came out of the shower. I deliberately made the drawing more baroque than necessary, adding lines and flourishes, especially to the breasts and pubis, which had become a mass of heavily inked black commas. My mother sat me down and placed the drawing before me on the kitchen table. "This is interesting," she said. "What is it a picture of?" "A machine," I answered. "Looks like a woman to me," she said. "A woman without her clothes. Is that it?" "No." She smiled at me and placed her hand on my head, then gently stroked my cheek. "It's all right if you've made a picture of a woman without her clothes," she said. "Is that what this is, a naked woman?" I looked away, out the kitchen window, at the weeping willow in our front yard. If you clipped a branch at just the right place and then stripped it of leaves, it made an excellent whip. "It's okay, you can tell me." "No," I answered, knowing I would lie as many times as I was asked. "It's a machine." This is called Confessions of an Alchemist. And it's not just about what I introduced this series as, but you'll hear. Confessions of an Alchemist. First, something happened 4 years ago. Then, suddenly, it was 30 years ago. And so on. There must be some truth in sequence, but no truth we'd put money on. So I took some time and hammered it into a coin. Then I took more time and did the same. It takes a lot of spelter to trade for one silver coin or 100 years. A gold coin's 1,000 years, but you can't make that in a single lifetime unless you cheat. Everybody cheats. For a while, I was obsessed with containers to store the money I made, artisanal mahogany boxes, portfolios of Italian leather, synthesized resins with compartments only I could unlock. This lasted years, which suddenly became decades. I could tell things had changed when autumn no longer hurt me. Now it was spring. And spring after spring took longer coming, the hurt contracting, a necklace of green thorns. But I continued writing, changing time to money, the sun, a gold coin, the moon, tarnished silver, and so on. My daughters were paper I wrote on. I wrote on my daughters, and I'm sorry. I have been forgiven, but can't believe it. I'm sorry, I say, and keep saying, as time transmutes my words into black money. Thank you. This is called Shush. The women are calling out the men, and rightly so. I am over here trying not to make noise. I'm poor. The only sins I can afford are handmade. Mostly I watch TV. There it's sex and death, dawn till dusk. It's 3D desire and Dolby Atmos. But where is it not? I want to climb in into the confetti mass of electrons to ululate among those golden mean faces, maybe snap one off like a virtual flower. But Mama said, "You dasn't, you dasn't." An imperative so whispery, so soft in the mouth, it almost seemed unsounded, telepathic. Mama's like everyone now, in a home, she doesn't know where. The sailing bag's been needled, she's leaking out. Anyway, it wasn't Mama who said dasn't. That was my Irish grandmother, who died early in a time when the terminal weren't told. I lugged the OED to a mahogany high desk and look. Yep, the definition of mercy has changed. But I remember seeing her before I went to college. She knew. It was in her eyes. I knew she knew. Okay, that's that little sequence. And I think you know what I was talking about. Anyway, it seems that way to me, that there was something coming into them. This poem is called Sometimes I Am the Fantastic Weight Beneath My Own Saddle. Did you hear what the rebels did? Dragged a woman naked to the town square, raped her, hacked her to pieces, because she put pieces of local fish into the beans and thereby spoiled their protection spell. But that is the very thing I wanted to do when I was my own horse, led by desire. Lord, we learn nothing, only go outside when the music of our narcosis leaks from clouds, then only to lick sadness from each other's faces. Sometimes I am the fantastic weight beneath my own saddle, the nightmare horse who feeds on flesh, not hay. This is a poem that sort of came out, I'm still writing some poems that come out of this conflation of physics and theology and philosophy and all kinds of other things really come into it. Everything that I've been reading and thinking about for years, it's called free will. And you'll hear that I don't try and write science poems, you know, I'm not capable of that. But science can inform one's thinking, I know that for sure. And I think that this is another one of those poems that conflates some aspects of theology, philosophy, and physics. Free will. When I consider the idea of space as notebooks we fill with words, I immediately think, no, there aren't enough words. The field shifts so rapidly, even if we wrote like furious monkeys, we could not account for a single morning. So I searched for another substance, one that might rise from three or four dimensions to take on the breath and volition of, say, dew on a blade of grass, which I could drink and drink. But then everything I touched became illusion. I had the Maya touch, which a joke everyone got and moved away from me. After I slept that off, I rose and found the world more or less as I had left it, but I had changed. I still imagine my eyes create trees outside my window, which I am free to call Jeff trees. Also, Jeff dogs, Jeff children, Jeff awards, etc. Without my seeing, this version would be lost, will be lost. I'm not the substance. I'm not the notebook. I'm not even these words. But I can, if I want, imagine I'm God. It is permitted. I've come to the end of the group. I can't remember. I didn't mark when I started, so I'll read two more poems and then I'll stop, unless I've only been reading for 5 minutes. I don't think that's the case. No, it's not. This poem is called Prospero's Happiness. We were talking about Prospero last night, I think. That's why I followed that subject a little bit with you. Prospero's Happiness. I was a piece of music pinned to the horizon. No, I was me sitting in a wooden chair. All sorts of furious thoughts collapse when you're not looking. There was the wall I punched three holes in to let what was left of the marriage escape. If you're human, there's no escape. You have to be human. Leave me alone about the new sins. Every one of them is ancient and familiar. Still, I feel useless and shamed when it's only the spell of the new poem holding me in its arms. And why am I not out there saving the world, etc.? That's culture for you. But I can't help it. Nothing beats a squealing newborn poem in your arms, all wet and huge-eyed. I could have been a successful scat singer on Neptune, I think, for all they know about scat singing on Neptune. On this planet, everybody knows everything about everything, except how it began and what's the damn reason for it anyway. Sometimes I think I'd be all right alone, but no, I need people. It's proven by science. Nevertheless, I took a picture of an island and enhanced my solitary presence there with Photoshop, a trick I learned from YouTube. Of course, when God does it, you really are enhanced. The fruit trees laden, the coconuts filled with milk and white meat. And this is, in fact, the place I have come to rest. Prospero, surveying his island from a mesh hammock, plush sky, stars and planets embossed, a garden, blue ocean, wife and daughters close enough to hear me sigh. a child of God eating an orange in the sun. And one more poem. All around me, people have the look of sky about to snow. All around me, people have the look of sky about to snow. Or I'm mixed up about this weather. In any case, Dan mopes beneath a gray brow. Margot's knees turn white with shame. And Bill has the forlorn answer to our windy questions, but no one stops long enough to listen. By now, John and Izzy have finished assembling their personal escape hatch made of money and the newly minted alloy of identity plus difference. Such as I am, I cannot add to that conversation. It's cold and late. If it feels like we're sipping aged Van Winkle in the middle of a battlefield, surrounded by smoking bodies, drink up, we are. Nevertheless, I keep waking in my own bed, which I take to be the fate of many, though not my bed, theirs. Sometimes the answer is snow, falling beneath the skin, a dry snow, one that cannot be melted or shunted without pain. Thanks for listening. Thank you.